Oh, it's okay, Skip. I'll just leave it there for now.
Be careful, right. This moment is recording.
Right. Is this from last week?
There's some overlap from last week, yes.
Oh,
we
see,
haven't kind of finished.
Sorry, I wasn't able to come in
okay.
The first 2 weeks.
Oh, it's okay.
Regret.
So,
four.
My computer broke, so I have to get your full session on the time, I'm afraid, because it's on my computer, which is broken. They took it away today.
Right.
And they said they'll take it, keep it for about a week.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Are you going to talk about Vaishnava traditions?
I was going to, but I hadn't finished doing what I was doing last week,
right,
so
okay,
I'll
yeah.
do that today. But
yeah.
I can talk about.
No, I mean, as you said, your dictates. So they're just overlapping to the fourth and so on.
Yeah, it overlaps.
Yeah, it's hard to fit it into nice, easy time frames.
I didn't prepare the Vaishnava thing. We're doing that next time.
Yeah, no, it was down in your.
Yeah, it was for the today, should
yeah.
for today, yeah. yeah.
yeah.
yeah.
yeah.
But we're.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'll.
We didn't quite finish last week, really. Well, actually, if we go through this quickly, we have lots of Vaishnava. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
As a complete set, Chris, isn't it? That's all.
Oh, that's all
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
I think I'm one short. Then.
Are you?
This one.
Oh, it's that one. Yeah. Thanks.
So I wonder this Kashmir group of Kaula. We have many call, PK call,
yeah.
So BN call. They are all from this Kukula
region. That's right, all from that
yeah.
region. We have a student here.
Yeah.
Mrinal call.
Yeah,
Mrinal call, yes,
yeah.
yes. Within the Shaiva tradition.
So we have some scholars like BN call and PK call, who
yes.
are cabinet secretary at the time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, so from the Kashmiri.
So maybe
tradition.
They don't know now. But their ancestors must have been following this tradition.
Indeed they were, yeah. yeah. I think Mrinal Kaul's grandfather was a scholar in the tradition, I think. I think he was.
Yeah. So maybe one or two generations back.
One or two generations back, yes. So we're going to carry on doing what we were doing last time, which was to... I started speaking about the non-dual traditions. The non-Siddhantika Shaivism. I can't remember who was here, I mean, but there was a basic distinction in these tantric traditions between the Shaiva Siddhanta, which is the normative kind of tradition, like Buddhism or something, and the non-Siddhantika traditions, which are sometimes called Kashmir Shaivism. But as Alexis points out, it spread beyond Kashmir and indeed existed probably throughout India. So I followed Alexis Sanderson's mapping of the traditions and described that to you last week. So I won't repeat that, but I will say something of the root text of the tradition called the Trika, which becomes the basis of what's called Kashmiri Shaivism or non-dual Shaivism, is this text, the Malini Vijayotara Tantra. And Abhinavagupta writes a commentary on the first few verses of it, the Vimarshini, and it's and on the extract that I've given you on the is from that. So I just thought we'd have a quick look at that, so you can get a sort of a sense of the text and the tradition. And the text is focused on a trinity of goddesses, a trident of three goddesses, Para, Apara, and Parapara. And they're all coming out of a central deity called Kala Sankarshini, which I spoke of last week. And he says, this supreme primordial trinity, that's the trinity of the goddesses, in which all powers are yet undivided. This is the supreme, this text is about, what he's just been talking about before, is about this, the text and this and the absolute that the text describes, and this is the supreme primordial unity which all powers are yet undivided. It is in it contraction resulting from fear through the appearance of objects vanishes, and the three powers of the subject, i.e. will, action, knowledge, are therefore completely dissolved in their own bliss. Now in that fairly concise statement you've got some of the fundamental doctrines of the tradition, that in reality there's only pure consciousness is the ultimate reality, and that all appearances are manifestations of that unitary consciousness. Subjects and objects are both grounded in a unitary consciousness. And if the term contraction is used quite a lot, sankocha, contraction, and it's used in the sense of when absolute consciousness contracts, then there's the appearance of difference. So the contraction of pure consciousness creates difference.
What causes the contraction?
The will of the Lord, the Ichcha Shakti. Why does God do that? Shiva has five functions. He creates the universe, maintains it, destroys it. He reveals himself through grace and conceals himself. So the contraction is the concealing of consciousness from itself, really. Now, why does it do that? It's a difficult question. Krida is one word they use. Play, sport.
Leela.
Yeah.
Do they use leela?
Don't use the word leela, no.
No,
only
in philosophy they do.
Yeah.
Lokavattu leela kaivalyam.
Oh, yes, yes.
In Vedanta Sutra they use leela.
Yes, I never come across the term leela in this
in
Shaiva
philosophy
session.
They do.
I found that krida.
Krida is the area,
is
sport
that,
of God.
Just the playfulness.
Playfulness, yeah.
Just as children play.
Yeah.
Without any
motive.
That's right. As children build
because he doesn't have to acquire anything out of it. He doesn't want to achieve anything. He's just playing like that.
Yes. It's no telos.
Mm.
There's another image that is one used in one text. So Shiva is like a king who dresses up like the troops and walks amongst the ordinary foot soldiers as a common soldier. So in it, contraction resulting from fear through the appearances of objects vanishes. So you have to overcome shankar, fear or inhibition. And one of the term shankar, one of the associations of it for Abhinavagupta is Vaidika tradition, is following the Vedic authority, which he says if you do that, you're governed by shankar, by inhibition, fear. You're paranoid, you're not eating meat and you're not eating garlic and you're scared of being polluted and scared of possession and all this kind of thing, and it's all inhibition which stops you from seeing the truth of the pure reality of consciousness only, which is monistic. So inhibition, shankar or fear, stops you from realizing the truth of this doctrine. So it's anti-Vedic. So will, action, and knowledge are the three powers which are embodied in the three goddesses, and those three are dissolved in their own bliss. That's a very Abhinavagupta kind of thing to say. Svananda. And this, what he just said, has been described by the master, Somananda, in his work, The Vision of Shiva, as follows. That's when he, Shiva or the self, remains in this state of being, dissolved in this experience of merely bliss of consciousness, then the powers of volition, cognition and action are coextensive with this state. So when there's only this one reality, the powers of cognition, volition, ichcha, jnana and kriya are coextensive with that state, they're not different. And he lives as the equilibrium of these three very subtle powers. Being immersed in this bliss that is consciousness, he is then undivided. And the opponent says, if Shiva is thus undivided and the self of the world, then how can there be, as the possibility of contraction is excluded, the riches of Shastra, etc., which are rooted in the formation of differential thought? It's a good objection. How can there be all of that? Yeah. Pick up a couple of more. And the answer is, we teach that all knowledge is part of the light of consciousness. Samvid Prabhamaya. And nothing but being aware of consciousness itself, as it is logically connected to the nature of light. Here, being aware means the inherent quality of the light to shine, i.e. become manifest. Prakashate, it shines forth. Prakasha is a quality of this pure consciousness. So there are two parts of it. There's prakasha, which is light or illumination, and vimarsha, which is awareness or reflexive awareness. Comes from mrish, doesn't it? To touch vimarsha. Yes. Chidamarsha ghanatmakah.
Tatra marsha svabhavo yam yah prakashah prakashate.
So the svabhava, the essence, the own being. Is the inherent quality of the light to shine, the prakasha prakashate. Is not this conscious light that which constitutes the flood of shastras? All the teachings pour out from this source. What is the use of further arguments? In this state, it, the flood of shastras, exists only as pervaded by the goddesses of the highest plane of speech, but not yet differentiated into a mass of sounds which are used in everyday life, another product of Maya. So there you've got this idea that this goddess is identified with the highest level of sound or speech, Paravach, supreme sound, supreme speech, who becomes manifested in the world in ordinary speech and different levels of speech. There was a philosopher called Bhartri Hari who was thinking is behind some of this, where he says that the language is divided into, there are three levels of speech, three levels of sound. What do you call them? Pashanti?
Madhyama and Vaikari.
Yeah.
Madhyama.
Yeah, Madhyama.
Vaikari.
So these are the three of Bhartri Hari's, and Navinavagupta adds this, or the tradition has this supreme level of speech. So this is Vaikari means
the spoken word.
Spoken word, transactional. Madhyama means mental thought, the language in your head. And Pashyanti, that's the potential of language. It's very difficult to actually, because it means vision or seeing, seeing. It's it's one of these gerundives, Shanti, the scene.
Because it's an adjective of vak, and vaikari, they are all feminine.
Right. This is these are the levels of vak.
All are feminine.
And so speech from this para level, which is the goddess, manifests into verbal speech through this process. And that's what he's referring to there. So there's always these mappings in this tradition. One idea gets mapped onto another, and you get this build-up of these homologies linked on together.
Always in threes.
often in threes, yeah, and tradition often adds another one.
Yeah.
So
overall.
Yeah, we've got three, but actually we.
It's they're all three in one.
All three in one. That's a, yeah, like para, para, and apara.
In here, especially because they have this trika tradition, trika number three.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, trika means threefold. Yeah.
Did you say homology?
Homology. You could have done. Yeah. Homology means correspondence. Yeah, homology. Homo, same logos, and theory of sameness, homology. Where did I get that word from? I think Eliade uses that word, homology, to
that's
mean
right,
these kind
yeah.
of correspondences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it is said in the Pratibhigna that only what rests in the self appears outside. Without it, an awareness of will could not arise. The nature of appearance is known as becoming aware of the objects that appear. Otherwise, the light, even though coloured by objects, would be like that of jewels, etc., which are coloured by objects but not conscious of them. So consciousness manifests externality. And externality can be reflexively understood to be a manifestation of consciousness. And if you realize or recognize that the world is an emanation of consciousness, you're liberated. So that knowledge also has a liberating power. So the goal of the tradition is to realize the dynamic nature of the manifestation of the universe in and out of consciousness itself.
Through yoga?
Through, through according to this text, his commentary on this text, there's three methods, Malini Vijayotra Tantra. I've got one, this thing there, you've got Shaiva Yoga on the next, on that sheet. And you do this through these upayas, these methods. Upaya means a method. And there's a distinction at one level between a path, a marga, and a goal, a lakshya. Now, that distinction is only relative for Abhinavagupta, because ultimately speaking, there's no difference between the path and the goal. In a purely monistic system, even that distinction is itself illusory in the end. So he speaks of, because you're using language, your language is inherently dualistic, so you're speaking in a dualistic kind of way. But in this root text, there are three immersions, samavishas, or possessions almost, three immersions. Three paths, three upayas, which are called the individual way, the anava, the way of energy, shakta, and the divine way, I suppose, Shambhava. So anava, shakta, and Shambhava, those three paths, which are linked to the three powers of willing, knowing, and acting. So the three faculties, the three human faculties, willing, knowing, and acting, are related to these three upayas. Let's call it the divine energy, and the individual. Now what that means in this text is that you can transform these three faculties of the self to a power which smashes habitual ways of thinking and realizes the pure light of consciousness. That's basically it. So willing, it also means desire. The term icha has a wider semantic feel, I think, than the English term desire, but it also means will. So the divine means, for Abhinavagupta, is the upsurge of emotion or desire which shatters thought construction. So he uses some delightful examples. When you suddenly see a beloved one unexpectedly after a long time, a great joy arises in the heart, and that can smash thought construction. You can see the light of consciousness in that recognition. When you sneeze, that shatters thought construction for a moment, and if you have this skill, you can see the pure light of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
In a state of fear, fear can shatter thought construction. In a state of sexual desire, that can shatter thought construction. So this is the upsurge of emotion and instinct, if you like, that smashes thought construction and allows you to see the pure light of consciousness. The second method is transforming the faculty of cognition or knowing. So you, it's the existential realization of a pure thought, such as I am Shiva, or I am omniscient, or I am omnipotent. That thought, you hang on to that thought, and then you eventually existentially realize it, because it purifies the other thoughts. That's a pure thought which begins to colour the other thoughts that you have until you realise the truth of that claim. And when you realise the truth of that claim, that's liberation. So it's a bit like mantra, but it's not slightly different. And this one, the third one, the action means, the transformation of action, is everything else is included in there. So mantra, or this mantra repetition, is technically part of the Anavapaya, the individual means. Kundalini, the rise of this energy of Kundalini that rises up through the central channel, that's part of the way of action. All ritual is part of that. So most of what yogis and people do is classified in this text as the lowest level of practice. And the next level up is this cognition, realization of pure cognition, then willing, the smashing of thought construction through the rising of instinct and emotion. Now all those are paths, are upayas, which imply a distinction between a path and a goal. Here we are, there's the goal up there, liberation, and we follow the path and get there. Now having said that, Abhinavagupta then says actually there's something called the non-means, which is the non-path, the non-method, which denies the distinction between the path and the goal. Which says that if there's only one reality in the universe, which is pure consciousness, how can there be a distinction between a path and a goal? How can any of these methods ultimately be of any truth? Because all those three distinctions contain the delusion of dualism, the dvaita moha, the dualism, sammoha, rather, the dvaita sammoha, the delusion of dualism. And the non-means, in the Tantrasara, he describes the non-means. I've got the text. I haven't got the text, I've got the translation there. The Supreme Lord is the essence of his own light and our own self. By what means, then, is he to be achieved? Due to his own light, he cannot be known. Due to his eternity, his essence cannot be attained. Due to the non-existence of a covering, there cannot be the cessation of a covering. Due to the absence of a distinct penetration of the Lord, there cannot be any penetration. Anupravesha. What then is the means? If it is distinct, it cannot be accomplished. Therefore, this totality is of a single reality of consciousness only, undivided by time, unlimited by space, unclouded by constraints, unobstructed by forms, unsignified by word, and are manifested by means of knowledge. I've got the Sanskrit next door, but I haven't got it here. Another passage of this kind of this non-dualistic language that he uses is the next passage, also from the Tantra Loka, where he's been talking about, he's described the great goddess, and then he then undermines it, says, no, this is not the great goddess. This is not the great goddess, the power, because it is not based on some other reality. It is not God, the possessor of power, because it is not the basis of anything. It is not the object of meditation due to the non-existence of a meditator, nor is it the meditator due to being bereft of an object of meditation. It is not the object of worship because there is no worshipper, and it is not the worshipper due to the non-existence of an object of worship. It is not mantra, and nor its object, and not the Lord, who is the possessor of mantra. The great Lord is not initiation, nor the initiator, nor initiated. So So it's kind of via negativa, negative kind of theology. But it's very Buddhist, that, in some ways.
Even the Upanishadic style, neti neti.
Yes, neti neti, that's
yeah,
it.
It's from the Upanishads.
Yeah, that's right. Neti,
Brahman
neti.
Is not like this, not like this. So after negating everything, whatever remains is that.
Is that, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the same. It's in that whole tradition, really.
Yeah. Buddhists actually use the double negation.
Mm.
In Upanishads, they use negation in the Buddhists because the apoha. It uses double negation.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Not.
Atad
yes.
Vyavritti. Atad, then Vyavritti. Negation of whatever is negative.
Oh, negation of the negation, that's right. Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Some Buddhist traditions, it's negation ad infinitum. It's not
yeah.
this and not this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So everybody, each tradition is developing on the other. They want to go a step beyond.
Yeah. And that's what Abhinava Gupta does. So he describes these three methods and then undermines them all by saying
not
actually,
initiation, nor the initiator, nor initiated.
That's all Advaita Samuha, that's a delusion of dualism. Because in reality, there's no knower, no knower, no meditator, no object of meditation. If there's pure consciousness. So. That's the basic fundamental teachings then. And this, the Pratyabhijna means recognition. And it's recognition of that pure consciousness, that sudden flash, that sudden recognition, that waking up. Now, the text of this tradition, the main sort of text, there's the scriptural texts, such as the Malini Vijayotara Tantra, which are regarded as revealed texts, which Abhinava Gupta claims for the monistic tradition, reads through the lens of his monistic metaphysics. But the independent philosophical texts are Somananda's Shiva Drishti, the vision of Shiva. And Somananda is about 900 to 950, about that time. And his student was Uppaladeva, who wrote a commentary, an independent text called the Ishvara Pratyabhijna Karika, the verses on the recognition of the Lord. And Abhinava Gupta wrote a commentary on that text. And Uppaladeva wrote an auto-commentary on the text as well. And in fact, Abhinava Gupta wrote two commentaries on that text.
Commentary on the commentary?
he wrote a commentary on the text of the Ishvara Pratyabhijna, the Karikas. He wrote a commentary on that. He wrote a Vimarshani on the Karikas and then a Vritti on that as well. And that was his last work, really, was the mature work of Abhinava Gupta. His work, the Tantra Loka, is like a padati, like a ritual manual, really, based on the Tantras. And he also wrote a work on aesthetics. And then Abhinava Gupta's student was Kshema Raja, who wrote a very fine summary of this philosophy called the Pratyabhijna Hridaya, the heart or the essence of recognition. I'm wondering actually if Hridaya refers to a certain genre of literature. Is there a genre of literature called Hridaya?
Hridaya as a form of text, I don't know.
No, I don't.
But Hridaya connotes that whatever is the essence.
That's what I took it to be.
So
yes.
They're concise, is it?
Yeah.
Concise. Concise. I did wonder if it was a genre, I don't know. And there's a teacher, so you've got a whole line of teachers here from Somananda right the way through to Kshema Raja.
Mm-hmm.
Between Uppaladeva and Abhinava Gupta was Lakshmana Gupta,
mm-hmm.
was another teacher, but he didn't write anything as far as we know. So Uppaladeva was Abhinava Gupta's grand teacher in the Pratyabhijna lineage. And he wrote the Tantra Loka and the Tantra Sara, the essence of the Tantras, which are based on the Malini Vijayotara Tantra, but which draw in lots of other texts as well. But the Ishvara Pratyabhijna Vimarshani is his pure work, his philosophical work of his last years.
Besides the Abhinava Bharati.
Oh yes, the Abhinava Bharati and
on Natyashastra.
Natyashastra, yes. Vanya Lochana, his commentary on that.
Yeah, Vanya Lochana.
So he did that probably in his middle years. One of his students had, he wrote the Tantra Loka, he says, in this house full of, one of his students, his wives had a house in a town near Srinagar. He went there, of course the town was a Shaiva town,
mm-hmm.
and he says that there are no kind of no foreigners or kind of infidels, kind of
mm-hmm.
so he could write his Tantra Loka in this pure place. So he wrote his Tantra Loka in this pure place in the house of his student's wife, without distraction. And then his mature work was the Vimarshini. So, and this is the some kind of summary of some of the arguments in the Vimarshini, which I thought we'd look at. We're doing this partly because Kiyo said that he wanted to look at the arguments in the Vimarshini, so he's not here. So idealism in the idealism is the philosophical argument the world and selves, the world is pure consciousness. So that's what Abhinavagupta's doctrine is, the world is pure consciousness. The appearances that comprise the world are not so much emanations but are that very consciousness. So although he does speak in the language of emanation, the ultimate truth is that the world is pure consciousness, is identical with consciousness, and is not an emanation. Because emanation implies a distinction. So it's just a way of speaking. Our bhasa, appearance. These appearances are that very consciousness. And seeing the world as consciousness is a liberating cognition. It stops you apparently being reborn. And Abhinavagupta says in his commentary on Uppaladeva's text, a distorted perception is created by a later correct perception, as in the case of someone seeing silver, which upon inspection turns out to be mother of pearl or mica, whereas a person who sees two moons due to eye trouble might later correct that perception by seeing a single moon. So our perception of the world as dualistic is corrected by the later perception of the world as unitary, as pure consciousness. As if you're drunk, you might see two moons, but when you're sober, you see the one. Or if you're, or if you, and if you have, we're looking at arguments for idealism, really.
Going back to Shankara as well, isn't it? Snake and the rope.
That's right, same images, yeah. He never refers to Shankara, he probably didn't know about him.
Mm.
But he does refer to other Vedantins.
Although he is much later to Shankara.
Yes,
mm.
He's later to Shankara.
Around 2 centuries
yeah.
later.
Yes.
You would think he would refer to
him. You would have thought so, yeah.
Mm.
But he doesn't. He refers to other Vedantins. He's
maybe
always critical.
That time, because it's one end of the Kerala and the other end is Kashmir.
Could
mm.
have been.
Although
have
Shankara
been.
Reached Kashmir, he established these four mathas.
Yes.
So he should have known Shankara actually.
Yes, but he doesn't quote him. It's odd, really.
Just out of curiosity, the people he does quote, the other Advaitins, are they significantly different in their theology from Shankara?
No, I think he uses the Vedantins as examples of non-dualistic thinking, which is erroneous.
Yeah, Abhasa itself,
mm.
which is using Shankara calls it Adhyasa. He's got in
Abhasa.
Abhasa.
So the trouble with the Vedantins, they're too inhibited, Shankara by they're too restricted by inhibition and adherence to Vedic authority. So they don't realise the non-dual reality in its fullness. So for them, Brahman is a eunuch, he says. It's Kleba, he's a eunuch. So the Vedantin god is a powerless god, whereas he worships the non-dual Shiva, who is my God's better than your God. And so this is his argument. If you, a perception is corrected by a later perception, as in the case of you see silver, which upon inspection turns out to be mother of pearl. And against the Buddhists, he's arguing here that he tries to establish the self-identical consciousness going through time, because there's this relation of contraries by Dhyabhadaka Bhava is only possible if there's a self-identical consciousness. So if the cognition of silver is destroyed by subsequent cognition, this is not silver, then it follows that this could only occur when both correct and erroneous cognitions rest in the same subject, which is a correction of the Buddhist view. So the Buddhist, he's talking, I think it, the Vaibhashikas, he's arguing against the Buddhist view. Here's a stream of consciousness with all these chittakarmas, these thought moments going along, and here's the world going along through time, with the moments of the world. Now for the Buddhist who he's arguing against, their perceptions 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are always behind the world. So your consciousness at time 2, you're actually conscious of event 1 that happened in the world. So by the time you have consciousness of time at T2, actually event in the world, it's called E2, is happening at the same time, but you're not aware of it. You're only aware of the event E1, because there's a gap between your perception of the world and your consciousness of it. And Abhinavagupta disagrees with this model. The later Buddhists disagree with it, so they came to think, well, okay, what's the point of this then? You might as well get rid of that as well. So then you have a consciousness-only school developing, which you've only got a conscious stream of consciousness and moments of consciousness, but no external reality at all to which it corresponds. Because you've already got a gap, you never actually perceive the world anyway, even in the earlier tradition. So Abhinavagupta is criticizing this, because they're saying that you've got one moment of consciousness which leads on to the next and so on, it's infinite causation, but there's no underlying self. And he says, how can you have one a perception at time 2 which corrects a perception at time t, and this t1, and this is an underlying self? Basic argument. But the determinate cognition of this is only possible because of the relation to other cognitions. So this only makes sense in relation to other things. The perception of the bareness of the ground entails an absence of the pot upon the ground. So the absence, yeah. So it's relational. Perception and cognition is relational. So you see the ground, a mat and a pot, and there's no pot on the ground, so it's... Pots and mats are the standard examples, probably because they're sitting on mats, aren't they? They're sitting on them and they've got a pot of water in front of them. It's like the philosopher's table.
Also, they sound similar. Patta, gutta, ghata.
Yes, patta, gutta, yes. Do you think patta is cloth? Do you think it's a mat that they sit on? I'm thinking.
No, patta, because even nowadays in traditional Indian dress, they always have a patta like this.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's
the
patta.
Oh, that's
all
right.
Yeah. And kata is the mat.
Kata is the mat, yes.
Kate aste, he sits on the mat.
So, yeah, the bareness of the ground tells the absence of a pot on the ground, or indeed a mat. Cognition is differential in that one cognition entails the absence of others. Error is corrected by subsequent correct perception. Similarly, two things which have appeared to be distinct are recognized through a determinate cognition to be identical, as in the case of a lotus seen in a blue, seen to be blue in the lamplight and red in the sunlight. So you get the same thing seen in different ways. So the world can be seen as pure consciousness or as differentiated. And recognition, pratibhijna, that the world is consciousness, correcting dualist perception, is the goal, the lakshya of the system. And this cognition could arguably be understood in terms of wisdom, vidya, in the sense that correct cognition is seeing the world as it really is, namely as consciousness, yata bhutam, as it really is in reality. And this realization, which he also says is the anupaya, the non-means, is immediate liberation from the cycle of rebirth, which Abhinavagupta relates to another concept, grace, anugraha, or the descent of power, shakti pata. And the two terms are synonymous. So the wisdom that the world is consciousness and awakened through grace. So you've got two ideas then. You've got the world is consciousness, and that is ultimately awakened through grace, that liberated cognition. But there's a faced with the paradox here. On the one hand, you've got the language of non-dual identity, in which the term anupaya can be located. On the other, we've got a language of grace, which entails a theism, and so implicitly a dualism that Abhinavagupta wishes to refute. So that's the problem.
Can I just ask, in the grace doctrine, is it implied that you can't get that realization on your own? Is there a kind of, you have to have an intercession of grace? There's no way to just sort of gnostically figure it out yourself?
I think there is a gnostically figuring it out yourself. And that he doesn't use theistic language very much. He resists it. And so he does talk about Shaktipata, but it's a synonym, it means recognition.
So the grace is sort of
self-grace to yourself, I suppose. It's a self-grace. It's an atheism, really.
Isn't it near to consciousness only?
It is, it's very close to consciousness. He quotes the Yogacaras with the
problem.
Does he? He quotes them. So I think you would think that, they've got some truth to them, but they don't have the pure revelation. It's a paradox again. How can you have a revelation if there's only pure consciousness? What's the revelation? Or is pure consciousness revealing itself to itself in some sense?
I was curious. I mean, who is Shiva, right? If he's worshipping non-dual Shiva, then is Shiva sort of manifestation in Brahman, or?
No, Shiva is. Shiva is the ultimate, is the absolute, is pure consciousness itself.
There is no other Brahman than Shiva for them. Shiva is.
But like the deity Shiva, is that any significance for him?
The deity Shiva is a kind of personification or embodiment, a way of speaking about pure consciousness. But it has, it's the thought that Shiva is a kind of being separate from you is for him a dvaita samoha, a delusion of dualism. Because there's no Shiva independent. Although, he begins his text with praising Shiva. I love your beautiful hair and your Ganges falling out of it and all that kind of stuff. It's all there. But
so could the grace be applied to the deity Shiva, or is it just
The grace is from. Yes, it could be. Yes, it's from Shiva as a deity. But that way of speaking, he says, is ultimately limited. In fact, when speaking of Shiva, you've got lots of different Shivas. The Shaiva Siddhanta worships Sadar Shiva, five-headed Shiva, and he is a lower manifestation of in the Tattva hierarchy. So different aspects of Shiva come at different levels of the 36 Tattvas. I gave you a chart probably last week of the Tattvas, I can't remember. You've got Shiva and Shakti, they're the highest levels. And then they emanate these lower levels in the pure creation. So you get, I can't remember, Ishvara. Shuddha Vidya. And Sadar Shiva. I think they're the five. I'm afraid you'll have to check. I can't remember off the top of my head now. And then you get they emanate Maya. Those Shaktis emanate Maya. which then unfolds the rest of the dualistic emanation. This is the impure universe, the Ashuddha Sagra, this is the pure universe. But that whole cosmological way of thinking, although Abhinava Gupta completely buys into it, is superseded by the kind of more philosophical language of non-dualism and idealism and the arguments that he presents in his last work, Ishvara Pratyabhijñana Vimarsini. So all that kind of stuff is in the Tantra Loka and his other tantric works. But the essence of his thinking is in his last work, which is this Ishvara Pratyabhijñana Vimarsini, where he's really slagging off the Buddhists mostly. In that text, criticizing the Buddhists, who obviously had a strong foothold in Kashmir. So he wants to criticize them. He's also criticizing the Vedanta in the sense of those who adhere to the Vedas. Because following the Vedas is, as I said, a limiting, is characterized by shankar, limitation, which stops you from realizing the truth of consciousness. I think Kshemaraja carries on that kind of tradition, and his Pratibhigya Hridaya is the essence of that teaching, really. And you know, and then the tradition where this dies out, you get Yoga Raja, who writes, well, you get a later, I think it's the 14th, 15th century Yoga Raja, and Jayarata at the 11th century. In the late 11th century, writes a commentary on Abhinava Gupta's Tantra Loka.
Is it that you can't go past that point? I mean, you know, there's a natural
stopping,
unfolding.
Yes.
Where do you go from there?
Yes, exactly. Where do you go from there? Yeah. Where do you go from the anupaya, the non means?
Mm-hmm.
The kind of thinking probably developed as far as it could, really. The ideas developed as far as it could.
Can I ask really quickly, you say the essence of his thinking is in the later text, which is very philosophical. First, how philosophical is it? Like, is he his style and his method fairly rigorously reasoned stuff?
Yeah, it is really. It's a mature work. He systematically goes through topics like causation, this kind of thematic causation, consciousness, the self.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually done through criticizing. Implicitly, if not explicitly, criticizing Dharma Kirti, actually. And the whole Buddhist tradition school.
And did he himself seem to think that that was the essence of his thought, this later philosophical stuff?
I think so. There's some of the sort of rueful verses at the end of that. As would be expected, it's the years of thinking and reflection coming to fruition in that text. Really.
Was his philosophy mainly a response to Buddhism, or was it sort of a standing on its own?
I think it stands on its own. It's a response to the earlier Shaiva Siddhanta as well, claiming that they've got Shaivism wrong. But also, he also responds to the Buddhists. And it obviously was quite a successful strategy, because it became the dominant ideology in the Kashmir Valley, adopted by the kings and all that. And went south and became important in the south to the southern Shaiva kings as well. And penetrated Southeast Asia as well. The Khmer kings were strongly influenced by this tradition. And it fades off into Kaulism, the goddess, the later tantric tradition, the Kaula tradition, the Sri Vidya. The Sri Vidya adopts most of this kind of terminology: Spanda, vibration, Samvid consciousness, Chaitanya. So you go to South India today, respectable Brahmin families of the Sri Vidya tradition, the philosophy will be largely derived from this, going back.
worship of Tripura Sundari, the goddess in the south there. So that's what I had to say about that. Oh yeah, one last thing. There's a lack of ethical discourse. Quite interesting. Did I give you that? I can't remember. Last. Oh yeah, just to end off that thing. This is not theism for anugraha. It's a spontaneous expression of unlimited consciousness arising from its own freedom, Svatantra. Well, that's the reason why, because it's just the Svatantra, the Svachandra, Svatantra of the Lord. That's why he manifests the universe. Expression of his own freedom. I guess in one sense then, God can't help but create the universe. It's part of the nature of God to do that in this tradition. It's a Svatantra.
Sounds like parts of sort of Leela theology where first he does it and then after a while it's the essence of God, the Leela is his, it's kind of what he does.
Yeah, that's right, it is very much so, I think. Use the word Krida, play. That it's liberating force of anugraha is in truth not the descent of a power other than the self, but it's the immediate opening out of the realization of both subject and object and here within a single totality of consciousness. And it's interesting that there's a lack of an ethical discourse. Avinash doesn't seem particularly interested in ethics.
Well, that's part of dualism, isn't it?
That would be part of dualism.
Mm-hmm.
No, but even non-dualists like Shankara, they talk of ethics.
Yeah. But as a lower...
At the empirical level,
not at the transcendental
level.
So this is, R.C. Zainer wrote that book, Our Savage God, and says this is what you get. You get Charles Manson at the end of, mass murderers at the end of this kind of doctrine, because it lacks an ethical discourse. Well, there's such a lot to say about this, but it seems to have come to stop with it.
Can I ask really quickly? You said there's a word he uses for play.
Krida.
K-R-I-D-A.
K-R-I-D-A with a dot and with a D.
Okay. That's interesting.
He doesn't use Leela.
And this idea of Krida and Tantra, it's not... Is it? I mean, Leela has this feeling of bliss, this kind of Ananda sort of feeling to it, but do these have a similar tone or a different tone? I mean, Tantra as an energy is a bit different from Ladini Shakti, as it were.
It's not quite as kind of joyful.
It's different sort of.
So the Shiva Drishti, some Ananda's image is Shiva as the king who becomes a foot soldier, and that's his image of Krida.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not. It's not like having fun with the gopis, is it? It's a different kind of image, really.
Slightly more aggressive power.
More aggressive power thing, yeah, that's right. Power.
So the arising of, for instance, Kundalini, is that also seen as happening purely through grace, or are there not specific practices to try and induce it?
Yeah, there are specific practices that induce that.
It's like a balance.
I think that there's things that it's mainly effort, I think, but in this doctrine there's this idea of grace. But there's a third level to that, that ultimately is not grace, because there's only one reality. That any language of Kundalini arising is limited. Limited kind of language. So he. All that Kundalini thing for him is just this level, it's just the individual means, the Anavupaya. Mantra, repetition of mantras and all that, it's just at that level. And then that gives way to these higher levels. So it's not a bit unclear. He seems to think that each of these paths, these Upayas, leads to some level of realization, and you have to go up them through the hierarchy. But in the Tantra Loka, they lead to the same salvation, the same end. But having never looked, it seems to speak of a hierarchy of means, with of course the non means at the top. So all that in, Kundalini is all within that, and grace will be within this realm too, really, I suppose.
So in the upper two levels, it's all automatic.
It's all automatic, yeah.
And is there are systems where, like, one begins doing Hatha Yoga and then it begins to happen spontaneously? And just things that I've heard, I'm just curious if they fit. And then the Sahasrara, there's a whole.
Yeah, that's all kind of later, some of that. The 11th century, you get a text called the Kubjikarmata Tantra, which has the Kundalini stuff in the six chakras. And you know, you do your breathing, and she rises up the central channel to the Sahasrara. In fact, this system has got another. It's got the Dvadashanta, you've got 12 fingers there, so that's the you meditate on that point, is where Shiva, and then there's another 12 points up there, just there.
Mm-hmm.
That's and then the Kundalini rises up to there, and then up to there, wherever it is, and then back down. And she goes back down to the heart, and you're filled with bliss. So you do get those
even that
effects.
Vashikha Bandhana, that the choti these. Brahmins used to have that
yes.
had something to do with this Brahmarandra.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm sure it did, the Brahmarandra.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That is why they have this
facility. Yeah. There's another Dvadashanta, which
is a scientific reason.
In front of the nose there.
Mm.
So you visualize Shiva there. Mm. Yes, and there's a triangle between these three,
yeah.
the three Dvadashantas. It gets terribly complicated.
How far do you have thought?
But all of that, Abhinavagupta is not that interested in all of that. He's quite interested, but no. Especially, he probably gets too old, probably, doesn't he? His later work is pure philosophy.
Is he influenced by any of the. Obviously, he seems influenced by Vedanta philosophy, although he wants to reject it in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he's influenced by the other philosophical schools very much? Particularly by Sankhya, by.
Samkhya, certainly Samkhya, pervade that terminology pervades. But it's not directly from Samkhya, it's via the Tantras.
Mm-hmm.
The Tantras are so full of the Samkhya terminology, like the Tattvas. So yeah, he adapts
or
adopts.
But somehow or the other, he's evading Vedanta,
isn't he? Yeah, avoids Vedanta,
yeah.
He's not interested
yeah.
in Vedanta.
Okay.
He puts it at a lower level. He maps, Chaimaraja is the one that does this, he maps these different schools of philosophy on the hierarchy of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So the Vedanta realizes the level of buddhi.
Mm-hmm.
But they go up way
yeah, the
up
level
there.
Of consciousness.
Yes, that's right. And the Buddhists realize the level of buddhi. It's
mm-hmm.
too hard to resist, isn't it? The Buddhists go to buddhi. There was also in Kashmir, I was intended to speak of a Vaishnava tradition in Kashmir. There was also a Pancharatra, Vaishnava tantric tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a non-dualistic Pancharatra tradition as well, which we don't know much about, and is apparently only now coming to light, really. Which was probably influenced by this Shaiva tradition. So the Vaishnava tradition seemed to adopt the Shaiva model completely of Diksha and the whole pattern of initiation. So Diksha seems to be of Shaiva origin, which gets absorbed into the Vaishnava tradition in the Pancharatra. So an early text of the Jayakya Samhita, which we looked at before, which I gave you a copy of, which shows signs of having absorbed some of this kind of material. Because it's an odd text in the sense that it seems to be non-dualistic in some ways, which is odd for a Vaishnava text.
Mm.
And so the Pancharatra, you've got two kinds of, you've got the Pancharatra of the Kashmir and the 11th century probably bears almost hardly any resemblance to the Pancharatra of the Shatapatha Brahmana or the Mahabharata. So it's a bit like Tibetan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism, or early Buddhism. You probably couldn't get Theravada Buddhism from Tibetan Buddhism. So the Pancharatra is completely transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Although it shares the common name with the tradition of the Mahabharata and the Shatapatha Brahmana, it seems to be so transformed as to be unrecognizable. And you also call it the Ekayana, the one vehicle, the one way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got these three texts, called the three gems or the three jewels, which are its authoritative source. And we looked at the Jayakya last week a bit, but it's all about ritual purification. And you purify the body through these ritual procedures, and visualize Narayana above your head and comes down into the heart, and you worship him in your heart. And you purify, you destroy your body, and then you recreate a divine body. And there's various practices like that. And this gets absorbed into the Sri Vaishnava tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes standard mainstream Vaishnavism. And they'll do Pancharatra rituals in Sri Rangam temples in the south.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of a temple which does which bases its practices on the Jayakya and Sankhita ritual, but certainly the Paushkara and various other texts. Do you know what texts they use in the Sri Rangam in the temple?
I don't
know. And there are very strong Pancharatra families that exist in wisdom and existence.
Mm.
I mean, I've got to put the Pancharatra fairly high
in Kerala. They use this Sri Narayaniyam, that I know.
Yes.
Guru Vayur temple.
Yes.
They use the Sri Narayaniyam of Narayana Bhatta.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But Sri Rangam, I'm not really sure. Did they use the Narayaniyam or something else?
No, I don't know what they use there. And this tradition went into Kerala, so you get copies. It's interesting, there's a manuscript, with two manuscript traditions of the Kashmir Shaivism. One is in Kerala, one is in Kashmir.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Narayaniyam is the Keralaya version of the Vaishnava text.
Yes.
It's very popular in Kerala.
Yes, yes. There's another Kerala text called the Tantra Samuchaya,
uh-huh,
that they use in some of the temples. It's interesting how Tantrism becomes much more ritualistic as it goes on through time. So all this kind of yoga and philosophy gets lost. And you get an exotericized version
and
of it.
And that is where the rituals just become mechanical. If you lose the philosophical side of it, then the ritual is merely mechanic.
That's right.
Unless you have the essence.
Mm. So in Kerala, Tantrism is temple tantrism.
Yeah.
It's fairly mechanistic.
Yeah,
kind of
very
ritual
mechanistic.
Procedures. This is how you
they
purify.
Hardly understand what they are doing, actually.
Yeah. I met one fellow who was trying to understand what they were doing, and he was writing a Malayalam commentary on the Tantra Samuchaya.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tradition there still.
I always go back to philosophy, I apologise. I'm just wondering, in his consciousness only thing, it seems that later schools often then try and look at, okay, what is the nature of ultimate reality's consciousness? It's relational. There has to be some sort of relationality in consciousness, because that's the very constitution of, you know, there's no such thing as a pure consciousness, becomes an issue. And that develops theologically, of course, it fits with the Vaishnava theology more because it's a more relational narrative. But is there any engagement with this issue of what is the nature of consciousness? Is there a relation, some sort of within it? Or is it really still, in a sense, more like Shankara, that consciousness is pure and the ultimate consciousness is undifferentiated?
It is the consciousness is undifferentiated, but in a different sense, in the sense that it's pure reflexivity.
consciousness becomes aware of itself through its objects initially, but eventually it's devoid of all objects. So initially there's an incipient cognition of I and this, as I, aham and idam, as separate. And then there are various degrees of awareness of that separation. And so the I becomes aware of itself being aware of the it, of the that. And eventually the I becomes aware of itself having contracted the object into itself, becoming aware of itself as an I having contracted its object. And then the I becomes aware of itself of an I having contracted its object. Even it's where the I becomes its own object, and then there's a contraction of even that cognition. So it's a bit like a black hole that consciousness disappears into itself.
It's an intensely dialectical process, you know, consciousness of the consciousness of the consciousness, but eventually it's backwards, the consciousness of the consciousness,
right.
The consciousness of the consciousness, and then just the consciousness, you know, this kind of...
It just sort of goes and contracts into itself. And it becomes conscious of itself as nothing, almost. And there's mythologically it's expressed as in the Krama system as the emanation of the 12 Kalis. The 12 Kalis that I mean, the Gupta goes on about as the essence or the heart of this, another heart, if you like. So although, okay, there's only pure consciousness, which is expressed philosophically earlier, he's dead keen on this tradition called the Krama, which speaks of these 12 Kalis as the cognizer, the object of cognition and the means of cognition, those three things, as ultimately falling back into this single consciousness only.
You say almost the consciousness of itself in the end, when you've taken away self and object and the consciousness relation between them, is almost nothing. Which is very much, it's kind of like saying it's almost Buddhism.
Yeah, it's
almost
Buddhism.
Just
that's right, that's
Buddhism.
Right, it's not quite. I've got a. This year since I've done this, let's have a look. There's 12 energies, 12 Kalis. There's 12 stages, if you like. Consciousness projects existence internally within itself. Then consciousness projects existence outside of itself, right here. Then consciousness withdraws existence. There's a stage in which then consciousness in this process of reabsorption reabsorbs even the essence of itself, though still with the sense that this reabsorption is my form or is my nature. So it's aware of itself as having its own nature. And then there's a level in destroying the nature of being a destroyer. She destroys even that state whose nature is a trace, a vasana of some existence. So there's as this process of contraction carries on, there's still a trace of dualism, that vasana, that trace which is absorbed, even that is absorbed. So at level 8, then consciousness whose nature is manifested internally reabsorbs the wheel of the senses. Then consciousness reabsorbs the lord of the senses, and having done that, it reabsorbs the illusion of the form of the experience, that they're a separate experience. Then consciousness reabsorbs the experient, even while almost abandoning contraction and looking outwards towards expansion, grasping and tasting. Finally, it reabsorbs even the form of that expansion. So consciousness implodes in on itself. And there's a verb, kalayati, that I've been able to use, is kalayati.
Even this use of the term vasana, you mentioned it as trace, isn't it?
Yes.
So the connotation is very much that of Buddhism.
Yeah.
Because
indeed.
In Buddhism, this vasana
so
term is used in this sense.
Mm.
Otherwise, in traditional classical Sanskrit, vasana means something else.
A perfume, was it?
Yeah.
That's right, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So it's using it in the Buddhist sense.
Nowadays, it has lost its original meaning. Nowadays, vasana means lust.
Oh. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah.
So this sense of vasana as trace or impression, this itself is Buddhist connotation.
Yeah.
But originally it was a perfume or a trace in that sense.
Mm.
That's interesting. It's very, I'm thinking rasa connections here.
When they describe Pravritti Vijnana and Alaya Vijnana, and also for this previous births. So how would you explain from memory? That's what the Buddhists were asked, and they refer to this concept of vasana.
I'm always curious about the way with vasana, and this, like the perfuming of the seeds in Buddhism, and also in things like rasa.
No, actually, the Buddhists use it like that, vasana of kasturi, that the deer musk.
Yeah, that's right. There's a real feeling that existence has flavor.
Yeah,
it has a perfume
taste
to it. Yeah, it's a very kind of sensory enjoyment kind of way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to keen on all that too.
The aesthetics.
Yes, phenomenology plus aesthetics.
Sometimes it's like in Chan Buddhism, Buddhists say that they don't eat onions because they reek of the earth.
They
smell of the earth.
See, smell belongs to earth.
I was wondering, so if duality is nothing other than pure consciousness, then where would sort of the soteriological motivation come from for individual action? Is it just to cessation of suffering? Or?
Yeah, I guess cessation of suffering,
That
would be that. That would be it, really, yes. I suppose desire for knowledge, desire for knowledge.
That's
a good question.
That sounds dualistic, though, then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Desire it.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to speak at different levels, I think, really.
Yeah, I'll get out.
Yes, what's the motivation? That's a good question, isn't it? What's the motivation? It's a terribly complicated system, and why try to learn it all?
It purifies the mind.
Purifies the mind.
You think for the kings that suffering wouldn't be the most compelling of all motivations, in a sense. You know, that must be something else.
Yeah.
That makes
acquiring something rather than.
Otherwise, you just take opium.
Good old Karl Marx.
Yeah. All that, I mean, his Gupta's example. He's not ascetic. He doesn't seem to be ascetic. He likes the world. He thinks that it's pure consciousness. All his examples are drawn from the senses, the pleasures of the senses, taste, good food and wine. Murals of beautiful women on the palace walls, he writes about, and the commentators pass over those in silence, in palace silence.
To have an aesthetically sensitive monism as well as an ascetic monism
in
any tradition.
Yeah, I've been over it as aesthetically sensitive. Yeah. And world affirming. He doesn't like the world denying death cults of the Buddhists. Or he wouldn't like Christianity either, probably.
Sort of Nietzsche.
The dying god. So, talking of smells, there's a quote from Kierkegaard actually just jumped into my mind. There's one uh, uh, once one sticks one's finger into the earth to tell by the smell which land you are in.
Mm-hmm.
I stick my finger into existence. It smells of nothing.
He's not under firmer, is he?
How came I to be here? I should like to make a remark to him.
Because it's beginning of either or.
Yeah, that's right.
I was thinking, where did I come across that recently?
Arsena. So I suppose we should wind up, really, but there's anyone. Sorry, we missed out on the bunch of archery.
No,
so we've got one more session, and it's going to be Caroline. Which is
any reason for that?
No reason for
no.
that.
It's part of your no volition, no motive.
We could do whatever you could do. If you'd rather do, we could look up anything that you'd like to. We missed out the Sri Vidya. We missed out on that tradition, Kala tradition, but.
Where does, I'm curious to know where the modern Vasudha yogis come from.
Oh, that, yeah.
You're not going to cover the contemporary.
I could do. We could talk about contemporary.
Just curious if you've
yeah.
just got a few minutes.
The Nath yogis, they come from the Naths, who adopted the chakra system. I wonder the Naths come about 11th century, was it? Something like that. The Naths, the Siddha yogis.
Sri Natha Dwara.
Yeah, Braknath. So they were coming out of a yogic kind of context. And Abhinavagupta is acknowledging all that, but he's trying to strip his doctrine of that kind of ascetic dimension, that yogic cremation ground tradition. He wants it to be move away from that. So we'll look at Carol next time, and perhaps more contemporary things as well.
Thank you. The translation of